You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again John Rubino. He's been a guest numerous times on this show, not often enough, but he's here again today. He runs a popular website, dollarcollapse.com. He's been the author and co-author of several books, one with James Turk, The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops, and a number of other books as well. So thanks for joining me again, John.
Hey, Jay. Good to be back.
Always good to have you with me. You still are writing for the CFA magazine, right, too?
Yeah, that's kind of an insider Wall Street magazine that has a lot of really interesting kind of nitty-gritty stuff about the investment community, which is really fun to research.
Well, it's pretty technical. It's for the insiders, kind of the guys on Wall Street, the people that are really making a living playing with other people's money, I suppose.
Yeah, it's aimed at money managers, which means it's nice from a journalistic standpoint because I don't have to define all the terms. You know, they know what everything means, so I can just throw the words out there and then go on to the story itself.
But you do quite a good job of defining what things mean, John, in your writings for Us Mere Mortals as well. So thank you for that.
Oh, sure. Well, that's the hard part about writing about any subject, really, is that you've got to make it understandable to people who aren't experts on it, but you've still got to make it technically true, you know, and it's not easy to do both of those things at the same time sometimes.
I understand what you're talking about. And I mean, for example, with the mining sector that I'm familiar with, to be able to somehow explain geological terms and in a way that lay people can understand what's going on is a challenge, of course. So, it's dollarcollapse.com, folks. Go there, enjoy a lot of really great stuff, a lot of free stuff. And one of the things that I really enjoy that John puts up there, I think every week, John, you have your top 10 videos. I could spend all of my time just watching your top 10 videos probably and get nothing else done. But there's a lot of really good stuff on there, and I'm not saying that because you put my videos on there once in a while, my interviews, and I thank you for that. But there's a lot of other things, and I just would like people to go to dollarcollapse.com. Well, you know, John, we want to talk today a little bit about the threats of inflation, you know, and I'm talking about inflation. You and I, who follow the Austrian School of Economics, know that we've had inflation. We've had it in spades. It's gone, though, however, into the financial assets. It's going into the stocks and bonds. I mean, people don't think of that as inflation, but it is, right?
Well, yeah, the definition of inflation in the Austrian School of Economics is an increase in the supply of money and credit. Mm-hmm. And we've definitely seen that, but you don't see it go evenly into all the prices out there. In other words, something will become a bubble and something else will go down, but you're still having inflation because you've created so much money that it's going somewhere and it's distorting the economy. And what we've done over the last 30 or 40 years is create absolutely insane amounts of money and credit, but the average person in their day-to-day life doesn't necessarily see the effects of it because, you know, you go to the grocery store and the price of food is up somewhat, but not insanely. And you buy a car and the price doesn't seem that much higher than it was the last time you bought a car. But if you look at financial assets, they are absolutely soaring at record levels, no matter how you measure them, stocks and bonds. House prices are back to levels last seen in the 2006-2007 housing bubble.
Wow.
And I just posted an article about some other places where we're seeing some really hyperinflation now. You know, Einstein, back in the 1920s, was in a restaurant, didn't have money for a tip, so he wrote a little note on a piece of paper and handed it to the waiter. That was projected to go at auction just lately for $8,000. It sold for over $1 million. Yeah. Paul Newman's Rolex watch just sold for $17 million, and it is an ugly watch, Dave. I saw a picture of it. You know, it's not something you would necessarily wear for aesthetic reasons, but some rich guy with way more money than he knows what to do with decided to pay $17 million for it. A British company just added blockchain to its name, and its shares rose by 400%. And then, of course, cryptocurrencies. You know, these things came out of nowhere and are now worth a couple of $100 billion in the aggregate. And with a bullet, you know, they're still soaring. So these are signs that all this credit that we've created is having an impact. It's distorting prices in different sectors of the economy. And usually, or right now, it's distorting prices in assets that rich people buy, because we're creating this credit, we're handing it directly to the 1%. That's how it's working now.
Yeah.
And so those guys have to do something with the money, and they've already got everything. So they're buying frivolous stuff or edgy stuff like cryptocurrencies.
Yeah. And well, they don't know what to do with their money. They've got some more than they know what to do with, and they don't know the people that could really use it. I mean, some people do. There's some, you know, some people are looking around and trying to, some really rich people are trying to find things they can do to help their fellow man. But for the most part, yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? It really distorts the economy, and I would gather also believe that it adds to a lot of the political discontent and unhappiness.
Oh, yeah. Well, people see a tiny handful of other people getting rich while their lives get harder and harder. And that explains politics right there. All the crazy elections that we've been having and the secession movements in different countries. People don't feel like the system's working for them anymore. But, you know, there's also kind of a moral component to credit bubbles that is illustrated by these insane prices being paid by rich people for basically frivolous things. And you know, when you think about, if you have $20 million lying around, right? And you think, well, I could buy Paul Newman's watch, or I could lift 100 poor kids out of poverty and give them really good lives.
Yeah.
And you choose Paul Newman's watch. What does that say about what the world has done to you morally? You know, and we're seeing a lot of that out there too, and that's part of the frustration. If rich people were getting richer, but doing demonstrably good things with that money, then the 99% wouldn't be as frustrated and angry as it is. But instead, we're seeing this ridiculous, silly stuff happening out there where, you know, London penthouses hit all-time record prices, and luxury homes just can't stay on the market. They're snapped up in an instant as soon as they come out, because there are so many rich people with more money than sense buying these things that they don't need, while the rest of us struggle to get by because our incomes aren't keeping up with healthcare costs and college tuition and things that are the necessities of life for us and that are becoming harder and harder to pay for. And that's not a surprise, and it's not an unexpected consequence. That's what always happens when you create too much money and credit. Mm-hmm. You build inequality into a system that didn't necessarily have that much of it before. You know, if you look at the U.S. in the 1950s, the typical corporate CEO made more than his workers, but not astoundingly more. But today, the average CEO makes hundreds and hundreds of times more than the average worker in the company. And you know, that's the kind of thing that leads to French Revolution-type politics.
Yeah,
and
it sure does. We're seeing a lot of that start to bubble up here. In addition to that, John, I hear what you're saying. The massive amount of money that goes to very few people, but of course that is made possible because of this excessive amount of money that's created. If we had a monetary system that was, let's say, equal weights and measures, such that the currency kept its value all the time, as it did pretty much up until Nixon really blew the lid off and took us off the gold standard. We had stable prices. You didn't have the ability, you didn't have this massive amount of money in the hands of the few to redistribute things in their direction. And not to mention that, I mean, it's just the malinvestment, the idea of these people are getting rich, but they're getting rich for doing what? And so you happen to own a Paul Newman's watch, and all of a sudden you become extremely rich, or you happen to have this scribble paper from Einstein and you become very wealthy. Anyway, John, you mentioned cryptocurrencies. I want to talk to you about that a little bit, but if we have time here. But I wanted to ask you a little bit now in terms of where this money goes. And, you know, it's created by out of thin air by the Federal Reserve. Alistair MacLeod has talked on this show about how this money is created. And the equity markets tend to do best when the economy is really at the bottom, in the pits. That's when you start to really see the equity markets gaining dramatically. And then he notes that as the economy starts to gain over a period of time, and earnings start to rise, you start to see the equity markets can start to flounder. Now, we're seeing a stronger economy now. You talked to me about that. I think you'd agree, or I believe it's your view, that we're seeing a much stronger economy now than we had a couple of years ago, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, in terms of top line numbers, in other words, employment and GDP growth, we're looking pretty good right now. But that's the way it always looks at a cyclical peak. Mm-hmm. So much credit is created that, you know, as many people can be hired are hired, and companies just finally decide to start building some factories, et cetera, et cetera. You know, people start to lose the cautious nature that they've had throughout most of the cycle, and they start spending. Well, that's frequently a sign that we're at the peak because you had to create so much credit to convince people that good times are going to roll forever, that you start hitting limits in terms of how much you can create. For instance, stock prices are at cyclical peak valuation levels now. In other words, every time they've been this expensive, the market has crashed. Housing prices, same thing. When housing prices have reached similar levels in the past, the housing sector has crashed. When unemployment has reached the current level, the labor market gets tight, inflation starts to pick up, or wage inflation starts to pick up, and the central banks of the world have to tighten, and that causes a recession. You know, we're at the place where in the past, all of these things have begun to happen. And we're seeing that, at least in the U.S., the Federal Reserve is starting to tighten just a little bit. The Fed's balance sheet is shrinking now. The European Central Bank is starting to talk about tapering its bond purchases. In other words, to stop dumping so much new money into the system. So when that happens in a coordinated way, when three or four central banks are in the same position of tightening, you know, shrinking their balance sheets, pulling money out of the system, that's when the economy will really roll over. And we're not far from that point right now. So we could see it happen through a stock market crash based on valuations. You know, when stocks mm-hmm. get just too expensive and they collapse, that could tip it over. Or one or two central banks begin to tighten in a meaningful way, that could tip things over. Or mm-hmm. any number of other things could happen to stop this the current expansion that affects people's confidence. You know, there could be a war, there could be a natural disaster. There's always something when valuations reach this level that stops the party. And I don't think today will be any different.
No. Well, yeah, it seems though equity markets will never go down again. And I suppose a lot of people are sort of coming to believe that. One of the interesting things that Alistair pointed out, sort of the dynamics that underlie why banks start to lend at certain points in the cycle, he mentioned when rates start to go up, and especially now that the banks have held so many treasuries, when rates start to go up, then they start to have losing positions in those treasuries. So the tendency is to sell them, raise the cash, and go out and start making loans, and the money finds its way into the real economy, and then you start to have an inflationary impact. That is inflationary in terms of what the government measures in terms of our living costs and so forth, to the extent they do that fairly. I think you and I both believe that it's not a very good measure of what really the cost of living is these days, but Do you see that dynamic playing out now that in fact, you know, with rates rising, these banks are holding treasuries, not a very good thing to own when rates start to rise?
Well, you can look at the stats on business borrowing, which is at record levels, which means somebody's lending them money, right? And consumer debt is rising dramatically. You know, the savings rate in the U.S. is back down to previous lows of the last mm-hmm. cycle, which means that we're borrowing money in order to buy stuff.
Yeah.
And somebody's lending them that money, so presumably it's banks, credit card companies, et cetera, which means that they've made the decision to lend money. So that fits with the dynamic that you're talking about there. Yeah. And again, that's a cyclical peak phenomenon. That's the kind of thing that happens when people just see the economy growing year after year and stocks going up year after year, and they don't buy and they don't borrow. And finally, at the end, they can't stand it anymore. And they start borrowing money and spending it and borrowing against their stocks to buy more stocks. And you get that final blow off. That's what this feels like. You know, 1999, it happened. 2006, it happened. And so just chronologically, we're due for it. And it does feel like it's happening again.
You wonder, to what extent the Fed is able to control these things, rates and so forth. And certainly, looking at Donald Trump has a chance, we'll have the opportunity to appoint a new Federal Reserve chairman coming up very soon. Most people believe that Trump prefers a weaker dollar, probably a promiscuous Federal Reserve chairman. And I guess those are probably pretty easy to find for the most part. But what are your thoughts on this? Well, have you heard any names that Trump may be looking to put in there as the Fed chairman? And if so, what might we expect?
Well, there are lots of names being tossed around, and they're pretty much standard business as usual people. You know, he's sticking with mainstream economists who Sure. already have a relationship to the Fed. But I think the important thing to understand is that whoever inherits the Fed is inheriting a broken system.
Yeah.
And won't be able to do anything to fix it because it's beyond repair. You know, we've taken on just way too much debt. And that debt has to be worked off somehow. And you can't get out of an excessive amount of debt painlessly. You just have to get rid of it through inflating it away or collapsing under the weight of it and having some kind of a depression. And that's where we are now. So whoever inherits the Fed is going to inherit the coming recession, which we're overdue for, as we talked about. And at that point, they're going to be out of weapons because interest rates are already too low. Insane amounts of money have already been created. So what they're going to have to do is double down, probably. They're going to have to ramp up the asset purchasing and just basically buy every bond in sight and probably equities too. And they're going to have to push interest rates down to negative territory this time, like a lot of other countries have already had to do. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that getting us back to normal growth again. You know, because that's such an extreme set of policies that it's more likely that it finally has the effect on currency values that a lot of people in the sound money community have been expecting for so long. Mm-hmm. In other words, the Fed can control interest rates, but not necessarily the value of the currency. Mm-hmm. So we'll see some kind of a currency crisis flow from the next set of things that the Fed does. And whoever's in charge, they're going to have to do pretty much the same thing.
All right, John, with just a few minutes left, we could see, if we have a stock market crash, another financial crisis like we had 2008, 2009, the dollar got stronger, right? So, but we could see, ultimately, as you're saying, they're going to have to double down and print massive amounts of money, probably to try to keep the patient alive, to keep the heart beating, that it ultimately will destroy the currency. Indeed, it has. The dollar, gold got up to $1,900 the last time, so we could be looking at something again, I suppose, a new high for gold, no doubt. And, not that gold is gaining value, but the dollar is just collapsing.
Well, yeah, if we see a replay of 2008, 2009, but on a bigger scale, at first, gold plunged and the dollar went up. Because the dollar was seen as the global safe haven asset. Everybody right. was buying it because they were terrified. And then we cut interest rates and created a lot of new dollars and generated huge amounts of new credit out there. And then the dollar started to trend back down. This time around, probably the response of the Fed is going to be so extreme that it risks a serious run on the dollar. The question, though, becomes where do we go if the major fiat currencies of the world are seen as no longer viable? You know, will we jump into cryptocurrencies, or will it be gold and silver, or will it be some other kind of real asset? I suspect it'll be all of the above. You know, we'll just get out of fiat currencies at the point that, interest rates are extremely negative and governments are buying equities hand over fist. We won't want to hold the currency that is the tool for achieving those policy goals. So if cryptocurrencies are still seen as valid stores of value that we'll buy those. And gold and silver always do well in that kind of a scenario, so we'll buy those. And I think the gold bug's dreams will finally come true, but it won't be a fun world when that happens.
No, it won't be a fun world.
Shouldn't think of it as a good thing.
John, we're almost out of time here. I want to ask you about this linkage that we're seeing now between gold and the cryptocurrencies. With about a minute left, Gold Money is announcing that they are now starting to hook up with some of these cryptocurrencies. Do you see that as a possibility, that the cryptocurrencies are a transportation system for real wealth?
Well, I think the most interesting scenario for next generation money when fiat currencies fail is gold and silver as the risk-free asset stored in a vault somewhere, so it's super safe, and then some version of a cryptocurrency as your transaction mechanism. So it could be, Bitcoin linked to gold, or it could be some completely new cryptocurrency that comes along as the transaction mechanism. Who knows, how that's going to play out. But I think gold and silver will end up being the bedrock asset in the system that we put in place of today's system.
All right, John, we'll have to leave it go at that. I agree with you. I think that's certainly the way I'm looking at it. History, if history is a guide, gold and silver retains its value. It remains money forever, no matter what the politicians want. That's all the time we have. Thanks, John, for being with us. Next week, Lawrence Kotlikoff will be with us to talk about why America's in worse financial shape than Russia and China, and what that may mean for your future, your financial future. And hopefully Michael Oliver will be with us as well. Bye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.